I'd like to begin today by turning and reading in 1 Corinthians 11, if you'll turn there with me. And I'd like to highlight a scripture to sort of set the stage for the message today. And it is 1 Corinthians 11 and in verse 19. For there must also be factions among you, that those who are approved may be recognized among you. There must be factions. The Corinthians had their issues, of course, but it could be pretty much said of any congregation. You're going to have conflict at times, but the Corinthian audience congregation was a very interesting congregation. Corinth of this day, when Paul was writing, was very much a cosmopolitan city. It was very hedonistic. Anything was acceptable. Morality was very fluid, if it existed at all. It was a hub of commerce and travel. Everything looked good on the surface because everybody could do whatever they wanted. But underneath, there were all kinds of problems. This verse here is very interesting, and it's fascinated me for a number of years because it was pointed out to me in a conversation, several conversations actually, I had with the late Bob Fay. And one of the things that he was trying to teach me in this verse was that God's church will never be free of controversy. And at times, there will even be division, contention, or even wrong teaching of doctrine. He went on to remind me, as this verse does as well, that this does not show a weakness on God's part, but rather, he allows this division in order to see who will hold fast to his truth. If I read this to you from the NIV, some of you have that translation, but I'd like to read it because it puts it in a little bit different light. It says, "No doubt, there have to be differences among you to show which of you have God's approval." This division is especially easy to see in the political spectrum of the world around us. In this country, we are certainly very divided. But what I find also very interesting in this verse is the way Paul phrases this. He says, there must be, or there have to be. The Greek word there is heresis. And that is the English word, or rather the Greek word, from which we get our English word, heresy. At times, this Greek word can also be translated as sect. There must be sects among you. S-E-C-T. Vine's Complete Expository Dictionary of the New Testament says of this word, heresis, that it means an opinion, especially a self-willed opinion, which is substituted for submission to the power of truth and leads to division and formation of sects. In other words, this verse is not used in a positive light. Let's go next, if you will, with me to Galatians 5 and verse 20. Because this same Greek word is used here as well, just to show it in context. Galatians 5 and in verse 20, Paul here is highlighting what many call works of the flesh. That is, our unchecked carnal nature will reflect these attributes. Following it are the fruit of the Spirit, beginning in verse 22. I'm not going to go through all of the particulars of the works of the flesh. I just want to read verse 20, breaking into the thought. Some of these attributes are idolatry, sorcery, hatred, contentions, jealousies, outbursts of wrath, selfish ambitions, dissensions, heresies. It's the same word as I mentioned. And again, by way of introduction here, God can use these factions or differences in his church at times to see how his people will handle it. If we ask why, the answer is back in 1 Corinthians 11:19. So God can see who will be approved by him. That is, so he can see who will meet his approval. What is it that God is looking for, that we meet his approval? Well, I think a big part of it is, will we be faithful? Some weeks back, I gave a series of sermons on the law, the truth, righteousness, and justification. And I believe a major part of achieving God's approval is whether or not we will be faithful to his truth. But I believe another component of all of this is whether we will create division amongst ourselves and whether we will submit to the authority God has placed in his church. One of the necessary disappointing aspects of doctrine in the Church of God is that those teachings has always been under attack. If you read Paul's letters especially, but even James and even Peter's letters, you can see that false doctrine was already making a huge impact on the Church of God, and they weren't even out of the first century. Within a matter of 2-3 decades, it was already pressing that hard. It was infiltrating the true church. And along with this historical record of that time period is a very curious observation to me that these various false teachings are not isolated in time. What do I mean by that? Well, almost every false teaching that we will deal with seems to come around about every generation or so in some form or fashion. Why is that? Well, if we again go back to 1 Corinthians 11:19, I think it's because every generation has to show themselves approved. Every generation has to go through the process of facing and addressing properly wrong teachings, holding fast to the right teachings, so that God can see who will meet his approval. We see this in 14th versus 15th Passover. We see it in the nature of God, the Trinity. We see it in calendar issues. And that's what I want to talk about today. Today I want to go through the Hebrew calendar. This is by no means an exhaustive study, but I want to show you in an overview why the Church of God uses this calendar in establishing when we come before him on the holy days. We'll see what is and isn't recorded regarding calendar in Scripture and where authority is given to fill in the details. So to begin with, let's look at any challenge that any calendar will have. And the first thing to look at is, what is the point of a calendar? Well, we have calendars simply to mark the passing of time and to be able to have a common reference point for future events and even past dates. Every calendar has its own challenges because every calendar is roughly or generally based on either a solar year or lunar years or a combination of the two. And the first issue then is to address how to reconcile these two great astronomical reference points from here on Earth. It's not as easy as it might seem. The Earth rotates on its axis roughly once every 24 hours. The Moon orbits the Earth every 29 days, 12 hours, 44 minutes, 2.8 seconds. The Earth then orbits the Sun every 365 days, 5 hours, 48 minutes, 34.5 seconds. And you can see very easily then where the problems come in. They do not divide evenly into each other. A day into a month into a year, and so forth. And so every calendar has to address this in some form or fashion. They can try to address it simply, or it can get very complicated. You have to adjust. You have to have rules. You have to have what are called postponements in the calendar, Hebrew calendar discussion. To back up and fill this in a little bit, some will say, well, the calendar we use doesn't have that problem. But it does. We currently use what's called the Gregorian calendar. It gets its name from Pope Gregory the 13th, and this was in the late 1500s. Pope Gregory had to address a calendar issue because the calendar prior to this was called the Julian calendar from Julius Caesar. It had a problem. It was becoming out of sync in the seasons. Specifically, Easter was moving out of spring, and that was a problem. Let me read to you an excerpt here regarding the Gregorian calendar. It says, this calendar was a refinement to the Julian calendar involving, this is how much it was off, 0.002% correction. The problem is, over the centuries, it had added up to more than 11 days. It doesn't sound like much of a correction, but over time it did become one. Continuing, it says, the motivation for the reform was to stop the drift of the calendar with respect to the equinoxes and solstices. And you'll say, well, why is that important? It says, particularly the northern vernal equinox, which helps set the date for Easter. And so what they refined was not the whole calendar. They didn't throw the whole calendar away. What they did was adjust some of the rules regarding the calendar. This all came through Aloysius Lilius. He proposed reducing the number of leap years in four centuries from 100 to 97, and by making three of the four centurial years common instead of leap years. Lilius also produced an original and practical scheme for adjusting the epochs of the moon when calculating the annual date of Easter, solving a long-standing obstacle to calendar reform. Most people do not even stop to consider that the Gregorian calendar is a lunar solar calendar. But it is. So what direction do we have from Scripture regarding a calendar? In light of the challenges any calendar faces, what does God give in His Word regarding a calendar so we can worship before Him on proper days? This is not a small matter. It is important. God commands assembly on those days, so how do we know when those days should be? Well, we start in Scripture with what we do know. And what we do know, without a doubt, is the Sabbath. In Scripture, we have a clear understanding of when that day is. It was established in the creation week in Genesis 1. We know from history that that date has been maintained. It has not been moved around in spite of various attempts and various calendars. We can track that in history. From Leviticus 23, we have God's instruction regarding when the year begins. And in other places, even from Exodus 12, we know when the year begins in the spring, roughly. We know that it begins in the spring, I should say. And what days of months to keep the various holy days on. We know specifically the name of the first month of the year from Exodus 12, verse 2. God told Moses, this is the month of Abib. Later, after Judah specifically came out of captivity, sometimes the name of that month is called Nisan, but the Hebrew name is Abib. We know from Esther 3, verse 7, that there are normally 12 months in a biblical calendar year. But if those are solar months, we have a problem, don't we? Because it doesn't divide into a solar year. And so we have evidence of a 13th month, what some call a leap year, having been added in the time of the Old Testament. This can be found by careful reading, as you see on the screen there, of Ezekiel 1 through 8. The other aspect that comes into play of what we do know from Scripture regarding the new moon. And this is where things can get very sticky very quickly. Because the term new moon is not clearly defined in Scripture, even with a very good understanding of the original Hebrew. There are two Hebrew words that are translated moon in the Old Testament. You see those first two words there, Yaria and Labana. These are generally the words used to refer to new moon, but the biblical authors also use the word Hodesh or Kodesh. Sometimes it's with a C, sometimes it's not. That word means newness, rather than the other two terms, which simply are terms for the moon. The question becomes, how do you delineate when a new moon begins then? Does it mean the crescent moon, or is it the precise conjunction? The conjunction of the moon is when it's behind the earth and it is in complete darkness. The only way to arrive at precise conjunction is to use calculation. But even the word Kodesh or Hodesh doesn't always mean new moon. There are a number of other references where it should be clearly translated as simply month or months. What is not in disagreement in the Old Testament is that a solar calendar was used. The question is, how was it determined? It's assumed by many that the Hebrew calendar was based on observation as late as the ending of the Second Temple period, which was 70 AD with the destruction of the temple by the Romans. But there are other sources that dispute this claim, that predate it by a great amount of time. But even after the temple period, there were two groups within the Jewish community, the Gaons and the Karaites. These were factions within Judaism. As late as the 8th century AD, they were disputing whether the calendar should be determined by calculation or observation. So we come to an interesting discussion, and that is the theological word exegesis. Exegesis simply means that we take what we know from Scripture and we apply that to what we don't know that is not clear in Scripture. For instance, in Matthew 24 and in Matthew 28, Christ gives his church the commission to go preach the gospel and prepare a people. What's not stated in that verse is that we're responsible for determining a calendar. In 1 Timothy 1, 4 there, and in Ephesians 4, verses 11 through 16, we're reminded again to not have disputes and to have godly edification in faith. The Matthew 18 verse is very interesting. Let's turn there, because this gets misapplied regularly. And it's worth noting, especially in light of this calendar discussion that we're doing today. And in Matthew 18, Christ simply makes a statement to his disciples. In verse 18 there, he says, "Assuredly, I say to you, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." So many have taken great doctrinal license with this, and they have changed very clear teachings from Scripture because they claim to have the authority of Christ. But Christ himself says that he changes not. God says he doesn't change, that these things are to be done for generations and forever. What is being talked about here is in light of decisions made based on clear instruction. Whatever a church determines, God will back up. Do we have an example of that? We absolutely do. In Acts 15, the New Testament church had to come to a decision. What do we do about circumcision? In the Old Testament, that was a sign between God's people and him. A very private sign, but nonetheless a sign. The Jews over the centuries had assumed that what that meant was it was necessary for salvation. And so the New Testament church, upon receiving many, many, many Gentile converts coming into the church, says, "Is this the case?" And they made a decision based on Scripture, which is exegesis. What was God requiring? He was requiring a change of heart. We read in the Old Testament even, God saying, I'm going to give you a heart of flesh, not a heart of stone. I'm going to circumcise your heart. He used these kind of expressions. And so they made a decision. And it was bound. God agreed with it. But let's look at some of the sticking points as we move forward here on this second point. What direction does God give regarding a calendar? The sticking points are simply these two. Did Israel use a calculated calendar or an observed calendar or a combination of the two? What did they do? And no matter what they did in that regard, what rules did they have regarding a calendar? Because again, every calendar has to have a rule. We have leap years to account for those fractional differences over time, to reconcile it back into the seasons. So let's go back to a discussion of the moon, because that is the one that seems to be the one that most people divide on. How important is the moon? And the first thing to talk about then is, what does the Bible say, going back to our exegesis? Well, we know from Psalm 104, verse 19 there on the screen, that it's talked about the moon appointed for seasons. This is another Hebrew word here. This is none of the three that we talked about previously. This word is moed. What this means is that God's holy days are either connected to the new moon at the beginning of the month or the full moon at the middle of the month. We do this on a regular basis. Passover approaches, we look up, full moon, it's time for Passover. Feast of Tabernacles, we do the same thing. The problem comes in that we have one holy day that's on a new moon. Which one is that? It's the Feast of Trumpets. It becomes very critical to know when a new moon is in order to keep the Feast of Trumpets properly. The second reference up there on the screen is Exodus 23, verse 15. In talking about the month Abib, which is the first month of the year, that word for many becomes very important because Abib has a connotation of green ears. What this means in practical application is that it is important for that first month to be in the timing of the spring when there will be the initial harvest for the wave sheaf offering. You can read of that in Leviticus 23. Some have taken this to an extreme that we'll come back to here in a moment. The last reference there on the screen, Exodus 34, verse 22, let's read that one because it brings in another interesting context regarding these seasons that we talk about. And it becomes important for discussion as we progress here. In Exodus 34 and verse 22, here it is talking about what we call the Feast of Tabernacles. It's also called the Feast of Ingathering. So in verse 22, it says, "You shall observe the Feast of Weeks of the first fruits of the wheat harvest." That's tomorrow. That's Pentecost. "And the Feast of Ingathering at the year's end." Now, what does that expression, "the year's end," mean? The word there is tekufa. And tekufa literally means a circuit or a revolution, a cycle of time. This word is used only four times in the Old Testament, and it's used in a couple of ways in terms of application. So we come back to our exegesis. What do we know so that we can clarify what is not as clear? In connection to the Feast of Tabernacles here, it implies that that holy day season, that timing, should occur when the cycle of the agricultural year is nearing completion or complete. It's not literally the end of the year, is it? Because what month is the Feast of Tabernacles in? The seventh month. There's still at least five more of the year. So it's not talking about the physical end of the year. We know that in the northern hemisphere, when we go to the feast, we see the fields. The corn's ready to harvest, the soybeans are ready to harvest, all these crops are ready to be harvested. Some, though, insist that this word tekufa means that the Feast of Tabernacles should not take place before the autumnal equinox. So on our calendar, that's September 21st. It can never be before that date. We'll come back to that thought as well, because this position is not from Scripture. To do so reflects a definition from the Talmud. It's obvious, though, that the moon is important in establishing a calendar, so let's look a little bit further at this point here. Again, we're looking at how important is the new moon. What many have tried to ascribe to the new moon is that it should be viewed as a holy day. But why is it not? In simple terms, it's not listed in Leviticus 23. God does not give us instruction to regard it as a holy day. Some have tried to make it so, but that means they've tried to make something holy that God has not defined as holy. That's very problematic. So why did Israel use a new moon? Why did they observe it, if you will? Well, we oftentimes view history in light of what we're familiar with. It's an obvious thing to do. But we've got calendars all over the place. We have calendars in our cars. We have calendars on our phones. We have calendars, you drive down the street, bank signs will have the dates. And, you know, we have all of these reminders of what day it is, what the date is. And in ancient Israel, they didn't have those things. They didn't have paper calendars. How do you guarantee that a month would be known when it was started by the whole nation? You would declare it. And so in many ways, a new moon for ancient Israel was much like we would call a civil holiday. You don't stop everything, but maybe certain things are suspended, much like a bank holiday or a school holiday. It's not quite the same as a major holiday. And in God's record of Scripture, it certainly is not given that weight as well. The question comes back to what we asked earlier. When is a month new? Because it is important, again, in this discussion. Is it the complete darkness, or is it the first crescent? To further complicate an observed-only calendar, the orbit of the moon around the Earth is not steady. While it's generally 29 and a half days, you can have as many as five consecutive months that are 30 days. How do you compensate for that, then? How do you anticipate when that might be? So let's look a little bit further at the problems with an observed moon. Many today believe that the sighting of the first crescent, if they're doing an observed-only calendar, that that first crescent is the correct method for establishing the first day of the month. But this method is very problematic, and it presents its own set of problems. The term, again, for when the moon is completely dark is called conjunction. This happens because the moon is behind the earth, and this happens roughly, again, every 29 and a half days. It also depends on where the observer's location is on Earth. And it also depends on the Earth's position at conjunction. The new moon will not generally be visible. That first crescent slice, if you will generally not be visible until 1 or 2 days after the conjunction. And the other problem is, what if it's a stormy day? You can see how it begins to present various challenges. Some will say, well, all of that, most of that is negated because we're not to observe in individual locations. We should observe only from Jerusalem. Okay, well, let's look at Jerusalem for a zero point, if you will. What do you do with the areas east of Jerusalem in determining a holy day? You have to make a decision, don't you? So you're living in Sydney, Australia. How do you know when the new moon is? You have to wait for Jerusalem. And you're almost a whole day away. At least most of the visible day is gone. So if in Jerusalem they say, oh, yep, tomorrow, or today rather, today is the holy day, they've lost half a day. Interestingly enough, as I began to study more of this topic, I've never understood over the years why the Jews keep all the holy days 2 days in a row. Outside of Jerusalem. This is the reason why. They want to be sure. Remember, they're fanatical. God gave them the responsibility of the oracles. We'll touch base on that one later. So in case they're not right, they do it 2 days outside of Jerusalem to cover themselves. And yet they still don't do that across the board, do they? Because they're absolutely convinced when atonement is, which I've always found very humorous. It's clear, though, from Leviticus 23 and Numbers 29 that the holy days are kept only 1 day. The instruction God gives is for this day, not for the next 2 days. So that puts a strain on an observed-only calendar. What this means in practical terms for an observed calendar, however, is that it's impossible to observe the Feast of Trumpets solely on the physical sighting. Because, again, it's a new moon. If it's cloudy, how do you know? If it's only Jerusalem, how do you know east of that? You may not know until most of the day is gone. This alone mandates a calculated calendar so that you can know in advance when Trumpets is. We'll come back to that thought as well. Let's look at another point here regarding then the calculated new moon. Some try to say that ancient Israel couldn't have calculated a calendar. The thought that ancient Israel could not have calculated the Moed, is a modern elitist and condescending view, to put it bluntly. What they're saying is they weren't smart enough to do the math. Calculating the new moon is not that difficult if you simply record the average times between the conjunctions, the complete darkness, from month to month. You're going to get that average very quickly. A lunar eclipse, as well, happens fairly often. We think it does not, but it happens often enough. And what is interesting about a lunar eclipse, it will only happen on a full moon. It's not a conjunction. The moon is not behind the earth. It is a full moon. The moon is in front of the earth. So by recording the time of an eclipse and then calculating the time between eclipses, how much passage of time there has been, you can determine very quickly, again, when these conjunctions would take place. Not only that, by having that information, you can calculate out centuries in advance when these would take place. By observing a common reference point, such as the first visible crescent, you could also verify it. The Levitical priests, and this is what's very interesting, you have numbers up there, one number. The Levitical priest calculated a month as 29.53059 days long. Modern astronomers were not able to verify this to the degree of certainty they did until the late 60s and early 70s when they started putting satellites up in orbit, and they could calculate these things very precisely. They've refined that number, if you want to follow along up there, 29.53589. That's how closely it was. That is a 1/1,000,000th of a day difference in calculation. You have a reference there at the bottom, Exodus 31, verses 1 to 11. And in that section of Scripture, God is giving Israel, as they came out of Egypt, instruction regarding building the tabernacle. And one of the very interesting things is there were two individuals mentioned there, Bezalel and Aholiab. They were given God's Spirit to make articles for the temple. In other words, he inspired them through his Spirit. Why couldn't God have done the same thing for those responsible for the calendar? To give somebody in the priesthood a mindset for math, that would not have been a very challenging thing to figure out. Some have said, though, well, the Israelites really didn't have a very sophisticated calendar until they came out of Babylonian captivity. So they say, well, the Jews learned these calculated calendars from the Babylonians. And again, how do they know? It's a bit of an arrogant statement as well, saying again that they were too stupid to figure this out on their own. What if the Jews taught the Babylonians how to calculate a calendar? Because there is historical evidence the Babylonians had all kinds of calendars before the Jews arrived in their land. And then suddenly afterwards, they had a very sophisticated calculated calendar. Let's transition to the next point. Postponements. This is another place where many get stuck, if you will. It gets very sticky for some because they say in rejecting a calculated calendar that postponements move the holy days and they do things that you should not do in observing those holy days, and so they reject them. The simple matter, again, going back to the earlier point, is that any calendar has rules. So not every 4 years do we have a leap year. If it falls on certain centurial years, there is no leap year. You have to have these rules, and the Hebrew calendar is no different. And so it really comes down to four basic rules. There are more, and there are sub-points. We're not going to get into all the particulars today. Again, this is more of an overview. But there's four basic rules of the postponements for the Hebrew calendar. And they all involve the timing of the new moon in the seventh month. Because again, you have to know when trumpets is. It is the only holy day that is on a new moon. So the first rule there, as you see, is what I call the Sunday, Wednesday, Friday rule. And this is that when the new moon of the seventh month occurs on a Sunday, a Wednesday, or a Friday. So you look down the road, and it shows that the month, the new moon, will begin on one of those days. If that is the case, then the Feast of Trumpets is postponed to the following day. The second rule, then, is similar in that when the new moon of the seventh month occurs at noon or later, or if it is on a Sunday, Wednesday, Friday, or a Sabbath, Trumpets is postponed to the next day. The next rule then is that when the new moon of the seventh month of a common year, meaning a non-leap year, a non-13th month year, if it falls on a Tuesday, 204 parts of an hour after 3 a.m., Trumpets is postponed to Wednesday. Go back to rule number one. It then postpones it to the next day. The Israelites had divided the day into 1,080 parts. We say minutes and seconds. They divided it down to these parts. So if it's 204 parts after 3 a.m., then this rule kicks in. The last major rule involves a leap year. In a leap year, in a common year succeeding a leap year, I should say, the new moon of the seventh month, if it occurs on a Monday morning, 589 parts of an hour after 9 a.m. or later, trumpets then is postponed to the next day. What happens here effectively is that C and D, the third and fourth of these rules, they regulate the length of a year. In the Hebrew calendar, the maximum length of a year is 355 days. We say, wait a minute, we have 365 days in our calendar year. And this is why you then have what they call intercalary years, what we would call leap years. You add those days up and you insert it at a later time. Without rule number three, a common year might have 356 days. That doesn't sound like a big deal, but remember, the error in the Julian calendar versus the Gregorian calendar was 0.002%. It adds up, and it creates problems very quickly. Some will add to these four a discussion regarding the 13th month. They lump it in with these other postponements, and saying that it is a postponement that is not necessary, but it is absolutely necessary. It's necessary to keep the holy days in their proper seasons. This is the biblical instruction. The question becomes, how many 13th month years do you insert? Now, as well within this discussion, and I won't go into this aspect of it, but there are seven leap years in every 19 years of a cycle. Some of you are old enough that you remember Mr. Armstrong talking decades ago about the 19-year time cycles. What this effectively means is that everything that we notice in the heavens every 19 years comes back to the same place. From our perspective, they move. It's actually the Earth orbiting the sun, but it changes in the sky. So every 19 years, it comes back to the same place. So how many of those, the Israelites determined that it's seven to keep it in that 19-year cycle, but still the question becomes, when in those 19 years do you insert those seven? And there are a number of rules that I'm not going to get into regarding that. The simple matter is you have to have these leap years. The postponements are simply calendar adjustments to determine which day should be proclaimed as the first of Tishri. And this is another interesting aside. Why do the Jews call trumpets New Year's? Because it's when you determine where the year should begin, not that it is the beginning of the year. What do I mean by that? You calculate to the date of trumpets. It has to be a new moon. Once you establish that based on these prior rules that we covered, then you walk it back and you know when the first of the year is. And from there, every other holy day falls in place. Let's look at some of the biblical evidence to go back to our exegesis here. We have evidence of these things in Scripture. And the verse that's on the screen there is 1 Samuel 20 and verse 5. And in that section, in that chapter, we have the story of David being protected from King Saul by Saul's son Jonathan. Jonathan and David had a very close friendship. Jonathan and David made an oath to each other that they would protect each other. What is interesting in that discussion in 1 Samuel 20 and verse 5 is that they said to each other that they would meet on the new moon. If you are observing a new moon, how do you know? And I'll give you one simple story in this regard. When I lived in New England, there were two individuals that began to go down this path of a calendar. We should not follow a calculated calendar. They both agreed. It should be observed only. One lived in what's called southeastern Massachusetts. If you know the map, the geography of Rhode Island, Massachusetts is just to the east of that little sliver of land called Rhode Island. One lived there, the other one lived on Jamestown Island, which is smack dab in the middle of Narragansett Bay. middle of Rhode Island. So one Sabbath, they head home. They were anticipating the new moon. One gets home. He saw the new moon, that first crescent sliver, excitedly calls the other fellow, and he says, "I saw the new moon." And the other one said, "No, it's impossible. There are clouds in the sky." So then the question becomes, who determines? And they couldn't agree. And so there has to be some way, again, to have everybody on the same page. 1 Samuel 20, verse 5 is a very interesting verse because it shows, it gives evidence to a calculated calendar as far back. I suspect it went back to Israel coming out of Egypt. But at least at this point, they had to know. It would be like us saying, "I'll meet you at the first of the month." And we're going to guess. We can look at a calendar and we can say, okay, that's 2 days from now. They were essentially doing the same thing. We come to the next point then. When we have to make these decisions, who has the authority to determine a calendar? And again, this is no small discussion. Going back to 1 Corinthians 11, does God want division in his church? He does not want it, but he may allow it. But he's also not the author of confusion, is he? So by the time of Christ, the Sadducees managed the affairs of the temple. They were of the priestly line. That was their responsibility going all the way back to the beginning. But there was a growing conflict in matters of the calendar. We can see this even in the time of Christ. Not all Jews were keeping Passover on the day Christ kept it. They were keeping it the next afternoon. What was not debated even at that time was what calendar to use. The question, though, arose and has arisen over time is, are these rules of postponement a part of the Hebrew calendar from the beginning, or were they added later? And if they were added later, or if they weren't, whose authority was given to do this? Israel initially and then later the Jews preserved the seventh day as a Sabbath, that weekly cycle. That's how we know that from history. We can follow it very easily. Doesn't it stand to reason then that if the Sabbath was that important, that God would also use them to properly preserve a calendar to observe the holy days? This is, in fact, the decision, the conclusion that Mr. Armstrong came to back in the late 1930s. And in the spring of 1940, he wrote a letter addressing this very topic. That's just an excerpt. I'll read a longer excerpt here to you in just a moment. The reason this came up was that there was division within the Church of God Seventh Day. The leader of that group was named C.O. Dodd, and he rejected the Hebrew calendar as a calculated calendar. And hit that year, 1940, he was planning to observe the Passover a month earlier. Mr. Armstrong studied this issue, and then he wrote a letter to the membership, and so I'll read this to you. He says, "Briefly, after very exhaustive study and counsel with brethren who have made a thorough study of the question for years, the facts are these. Research reveals two basic points on this question of intercalary months." That's the leap year. "First, God did not record it in the Bible, which gives us absolutely nothing more to go on than I have stated above. Second, history is vague on the subject, shedding little light that can be accepted and trusted. Yet we know God gave his people a fixed rule for calculating time periods and for figuring when to hold the festivals of Jehovah. In conclusion, unless God has preserved his sacred calendar through the Jews," this is an important point, "then we do not know how to figure Passover or any of the holy days this year." And I would add, in any year. Right? Let's follow that logic through. Are the holy days important? Yes, they are, for a variety of reasons. We'll rehearse more of those tomorrow even. If we then need to know what day it is on, how do we know it is the right day? God would have to preserve that information. To continue here, he says, there is no authority for any other way. There is no biblical authority whatsoever for figuring the first day of the first month from the new moon nearest the spring equinox. And again, this is a discussion I'll come to in another moment. God did not commit his oracles or the preservation of his times to profane history or to the Roman Catholics, but to the Israelites, and they have been preserved by the Jews. And let's look at that verse in Romans chapter 3 in verse 1. Some will negate this and say, no, this is only talking about recorded scripture. But again, the point is, how do we know when to keep the holy days? If we agree that they are important to keep, we have to know when to keep them. Because keeping them on the wrong day is just as wrong or bad as not keeping them at all. Right? God says it's important. This day is holy. Romans 3 and verse 1 simply says, what advantage then has the Jew, or what profit is the circumcision? What did God give them? Much in every way, chiefly because to them were committed the oracles of God, the instruction from him. For what if some did not believe? Will their belief make the faithfulness of God without effect? So, to them were committed. Now, we have that clearly in scriptures, specifically the Old Testament. And again, it also has to include, to some degree, this matter of a calendar, because the holy days are critical. So let's look at this from what we do know regarding the instruction God gave his holy days. Let's look at the next verse up there, and that's Leviticus 23. This is the chapter that lays out for us the holy days that we are to observe through a calendar year. And in Leviticus 23 and verse 2, in setting the stage here, God speaking to Moses says this, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, the feasts of the eternal, which you shall proclaim to be holy, these are my feasts. And then he goes on to illustrate those, to line them out. And interestingly, he starts in the very next verse with the Sabbath day. What is interesting in there is the word mikrah. You shall proclaim. The word convocation is the word mikra. So there at the end, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations. That word mikra is an interesting word. But before we get to that, in verse 8 of Numbers 10. Let me back up a little bit. In Numbers 10 and verse 2, I have that verse up there. Moses is told regarding the instruction God was giving him for a variety of things. He was told to make two silver trumpets. These were not the shofar ram horns. These were silver trumpets. They were to be used specifically for the calling of the congregation. That word calling is that word mikra, M-I-Q-R-A. In Numbers 10 and verse 8, we also then find in that responsibility of calling the congregation, that responsibility was given to Aaron's sons, the priests. So in Numbers 10, verse 10 then, one such time that they were to blow those silver trumpets was at the beginning of the month. So let's look a little bit more at this word mikra. It is derived from a verb, kara, Q-A-R-A, which means to proclaim, which is what we read in Leviticus 23:2. Is the same word used in Genesis 1:5, where God proclaimed the light day and the darkness night. It's used as well in Genesis 1:8, where God called the firmament heaven, and he called the dry land earth, and he called the waters sea. He proclaimed them. Later in Genesis 2, verse 19, that same verb, kara, is used when Adam called each living creature its name. He proclaimed what it was. So in Genesis 1, it was God proclaiming or calling. In chapter 2, it was Adam calling. So in here in Leviticus 23 then, God told a certain group. Notice again, verse 2, Leviticus 23, the feasts of the eternal which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations. Who is the you? The priesthood. God is talking to the priesthood here. And so the priesthood was given the responsibility of calling the congregation on these holy days. So they needed to know, didn't they? They needed to know when to assemble the congregation before God. Numbers 10 also shows us that the you in this group was the priesthood. They were the ones given the responsibility to call to assemble a congregation. It was not an individual matter for each Israelite. The dates were to be proclaimed by an authoritative body, and the priesthood was the group given that responsibility. as Adam was to name the animals, the priests were given the responsibility to designate what dates would be the holy days. So let's look at one last section here, and then we're going to break, and we'll pick the rest of this up in the Bible study portion. 1 Corinthians 14 and verse 33. I mentioned this in passing earlier. How chaotic is it as we look out across the landscape of various churches and all the various calendars that they have? I doubt God is pleased with that because it becomes a point of division. And that is not what God is pleased with. 1 Corinthians 14 and verse 33, we have a very telling verse here. It says, "For God is not the author of confusion." So the confusion on a calendar issue does not come from God. It comes from men. Notice as well, it says, "But rather of peace." God is the author of peace, as in all the churches of the saints. If each of us sought to determine our own calendar, we would all end up probably on different dates. Even if we ended up on the same date in a particular month, we may not have the same regard for what the length of the year is. And it becomes very confusing very quickly. I have the verse up on the screen there, Colossians 2, 16 and 17. One of the things that Paul told the congregation at Colossae was that they were to not let any man judge them in matters regarding the holy days, the moons, or the Sabbath. Why would he bring the new moons into this? Many have misused this verse to say that Paul was saying it's all done away with. But rather, it's the opposite. What you have there is a group of Gentiles now that are following what? A different calendar. It's not the Roman calendar. The ones condemning them were internally, most likely Jewish converts that were taking them to task because they weren't observing it properly according to what they thought. Because new moons are only relevant in the discussion that Paul was having if you're keeping a biblical calendar. So in other words, he says, don't let others judge you, but rather the church determines it. So to put a fine point on it, does God expect every Christian, or the church as a whole even, to determine a calendar? The simple answer is no. And that's where we'll pick it up